How to Survive the Worst Tornado in American History. Let's say you want to see a classic American rail town. Maybe you're a rail fan, a train tourist, a foamer, as conductors pejoratively call them. You want to see when rail tracks served as America's arteries and when conductors in striped overalls powered American commerce. So you travel back to March 18, 1925, to visit the train station in the small rail town of Gorham, Illinois. You'll watch as dozens of steam engines pull through one of the busiest crossings in America. You'll see soot-covered crews shovel coal into boilers. And at 2:30 that afternoon, you'll see a black fog approaching rapidly from the southwest. At first, you may not be concerned. Like fog, this blackness has no discernible shape. There's no clear funnel curling down from a dark anvil cloud. There's no whip-like vortex framed against a clear sky. The dark mass merely blends into the towering cloud above as if the cloud itself had merely sagged to the ground. But concern may soon replace your initial curiosity when you notice the fog isn't behaving like a traditional watery gloom. As the seconds pass, you'll realize it's not creeping across the water or simply condensing across the horizon. It's ripping toward you like a stock car in fifth gear. Then you'll hear its noise. What begins as a low hum will soon crescendo into a deafening shriek that one witness later describes as a whistling, siren-like death song. The fog you see is actually a sheath of heavy rain. Hiding behind it is the most powerful tornado in recorded history. The Tri-State Tornado, as the newspapers later dubbed it, was a meteorological freak. No tornado has ever blown harder, moved faster, or lasted longer. While the average tornado spins for fewer than 10 minutes, Tri-State averaged 59 miles per hour over 3.5 hours for 219 miles across three states. And while the average tornado advances at 30 miles per hour, when the Tri-State Tornado crossed the Mississippi River and smacked into Gorham, it was moving at an astonishing 73 miles per hour, the fastest in recorded history. On the enhanced Fujita scale, which meteorologists use to classify a tornado's power, a maximum EF5 designation signifies sustained wind velocities of at least 200 miles per hour. Fewer than 1% of tornadoes even attain this speed. Tri-State dwarfed it. At its height, Tri-State's winds exceeded 300 miles per hour. Even among the rarest, most catastrophic weather events that can occur on Earth, Tri-State stands above. It peeled pavement, unzipped railroad track, hurled 100-ton locomotives, tossed tractors into homes, and splintered nearly every building it touched. It cut a mile-wide gash through southern Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana, and killed at least 695 people, double the death toll of the second deadliest tornado in American history. The Tri-State Tornado holds every significant tornadic record that a twisted cloud could ever hope to accomplish. It's the Secretariat of Tornadoes, and southwestern Illinois was the backstretch of its Belmont. If young clouds hung posters on their wall, they would be shots of the Tri-State supercell as it crossed the Mississippi. There may not be, in the recorded history of atmospheric wrath, a single more ominous sight than the shrieking black fog you see from the window of the Gorham train station at 2:30 that March afternoon. The Tri-State Tornado's demonic combination of speed, duration, and power make it such a meteorological anomaly that almost a century later, a group of tornado experts led by Robert Maddox, the former director of the National Severe Storms Laboratory, set out to discover how the skies produced such a monster. According to Maddox, it began, as nearly all weather systems do, with a drop in pressure. Tornadoes are the end result of an extraordinary series of events involving so many variables that many meteorologists doubt whether we will ever be able to predict their formation with any certainty. At their core, though, they are the explosive, unpredictable result of an atmospheric contortionist act that occurs when air masses of different temperatures and humidities collide. Smaller versions of these collisions occur every day all over the globe, but the North American Midwest hosts more than 75% of the world's tornadoes because its long flatlands provide a unique, unobstructed atmospheric pathway from Mexico to Canada. As a result, collisions in the Midwest play out on a continental scale. Every spring, when the winter jet stream still blows with enough force to create a strong low-pressure vacuum, And when the skies above Mexico warm, but it remains cold over Canada, the Midwest hosts the atmosphere's greatest demolition derby. And because low pressure draws air in, its development acts like the Kearney's opening call. At 7 p.m. on March 16, 1925, 2 days before your arrival in Illinois, jet stream winds blasting west to east above Helena, Montana, swerved into the lee of the Rocky Mountains. This sudden southerly swing created an atmospheric vacuum called a low-pressure trough above western Montana. The vacuum sucked in hot, dry air from the deserts of Mexico, cool, moist air from the Gulf, and frigid air from over the southern Canadian tundra. The triumvirate of airs moved toward low pressure, but areas of low pressure are not stationary targets. They move down the jet stream like the undulation in a flicked rope, so that 18 hours after the low pressure's initial formation, it no longer sat over Helena, but had moved almost 1,500 miles to the south-southwest. On the morning of March 17th, Mexican desert air and muggy Gulf air finally caught up and impacted above Springfield, Missouri. When hot, dry desert air collides with the cool, moist air from the Mexican Gulf, the two blocks of air don't blend together. They slam and slide like the scrum in a rugby match. The change in wind, temperature, and humidity can occur so suddenly that someone crossing the street could feel the shift in weather in the time it takes to reach the far side. This vertical line of impact, called a dry line, begins at the ground and rises tens of thousands of feet into the high atmosphere, but as it does, it doesn't remain perfectly perpendicular. Instead, shifting winds above the ground can push the hot, dry Mexican desert air over cool, moist air from the Gulf. This arrangement, called a cap, is an atmospheric pipe bomb. Normally, hot air sits below cool, but in the twisted pileup of this collision, the temperature actually warms as it gains altitude. The result is potentially explosive. As the day warms, ground-hugging air warmed by the radiant heat of the Earth cannot rise. Instead, it sits, its temperature climbs, and the pressure beneath the cap builds like a boiling kettle with no spout. Storm chasers call this situation the loaded gun, but for the gun to go off, there must be a trigger. Something must lift the Gulf air above the thin, hot cap. In the most powerful storms, that trigger is wind. By lunchtime on March 18th, the cold air and southerly winds from Canada finally arrived and smashed into the Gulf's northerly gusts. Like two speeding jalopies, the two opposing winds impacted and lifted in the collision, boosting the wet Gulf air through the cap. In the cooler air of the upper atmosphere, the warm, wet air rocketed upward at speeds in excess of 70 miles per hour. Finally, after rising as high as 60,000 feet, the updraft lost its heat, dumped its water to form clouds and rain, and lost even more heat in the chemical conversion. Now supercooled and dense, the air plummeted back down, smashing into the earth and ejecting outward with enough force to cause tornado-like damage on the ground. Like opposing currents twisting into a river's vortex, the winds and the cloud began to rotate around each other. The result was a spinning saucer-like thundercloud with an eerie turquoise glow, a product of the sun filtering through rain and ice, called a supercell. Most supercells do not form tornadoes. They deliver baseball-sized hail, lightning, thunder, torrential rain, and powerful winds, and though they twist menacingly, few ever bring that rotation to Earth. But if the updraft and downdraft blasting into and around the thundercloud along the ground pinch together, they can begin to twist around each other. And if the supercell's updraft is strong enough, it can lift and stretch this horizontal vortex into its cloud, a process that greatly increases the wind's rotation for the same reason an ice skater's spin rate increases when the skater pulls in their arms. In seconds, an updraft can tighten a large circuitous rotation capable of banging a house's screen door into a tube of focused fury that can rip a house from its foundation. At 1:01 p.m. on March 18, 1925, 3 miles outside Ellington, Missouri, the winds of the tri-state supercell crossed this threshold. According to witnesses, the tornado began both narrow and elongate in the classic and easily identifiable tornadic formation, but within minutes, this small twisting tornado grew to more than a mile in diameter. Soon afterward, a 49-year-old farmer named Samuel Flowers became its first victim when he was overtaken just outside Ellington while trying to escape on horseback. Sitting in the train station in Gorham, Illinois, you're nearly 100 miles from Mr. Flowers. Ordinarily, that would place you comfortably out of a tornado's range. Normally, nature cannot sustain the cohesion required to maintain a tornado for longer than a few miles, and long before it arrived in Gorham, it would have run out of pressurized air or wandered away from the area of the tornado-forming collision. But that's not what happened. This time, sitting in the Gorham's train station not only places you comfortably within this tornado's range, it places you in the exact location where it will reach its greatest fury. The meteorological explanation for Tri-State's unprecedented stamina begins with an entirely unrelated rain squall that happened to pass through earlier that morning. The rain chilled the air over southern Illinois and created a large temperature difference over a small area. Because tornadoes feed off both warm and cool air, the rain shower laid what amounted to a narrow, tornado-friendly track across the Midwest, and in an unprecedented display of cohesion, the supercell, the dry line, and the low-pressure system all moved in unison straight down the narrow band like a blindfolded motorcyclist blasting down a tightrope. In the 1920s, the Midwest had no tornado warning system. This was partially on purpose, as back then a tornado forecast never reliably produced anything more than panic. The U.S. Weather Bureau even went so far as to ban its forecasters from uttering the T word. If you check the paper for the day's weather, all you'll see in the forecast is a call for rains and strong shifting winds, a 1920s meteorological euphemism meaning the day's weather might either blow your house down or be a good day to fly a kite. As a result, the first sign of trouble won't appear until just before 2:30 in the afternoon, when you watch from the train station as the howling black cloud tears across the Mississippi River at 70 miles per hour. When you realize the terror racing toward you, you may be tempted to try to escape its path. This is a mistake. But if you're going to try, there are a few things to keep in mind. First, run in the right direction. This sounds dumb and obvious. It isn't. Instinct may compel you to run in the opposite direction of the tornado's approach. This is wrong. The tornado is advancing at the pace of a speeding train. Running away from it would be like escaping a train by running down the tracks. Pursue this path, and you will at best delay your demise by a few seconds. Instead, you should run perpendicular to its path. In this case, as in the case of most tornadoes, but not all, you need to run north or south. Like most tornadoes, Tri-State tracks east-northeast as it follows the path of the jet stream. Clearing the path of the tornado would be fairly simple in ideal conditions. Even the comparatively massive vortex of the Tri-State only spans a mile in width, which means you could escape if you move just a half mile. If you're a strong runner, performing in ideal conditions, you could cover the distance in 5 or so minutes. Unfortunately, conditions are far from perfect, and it's not just the buckets of rain and baseball-sized hail. The real killer is the headwind. As a tornado advances, it draws air into its updraft like a superpowered vacuum, creating a hellacious headwind preceding its path. The colliding fronts to its north and south compound the problem. These blow wind from both north and south into the inflow, placing you in a pincer movement-like vise of jet exhaust-level headwinds. This deeply complicates the running conditions for a bipedal creature like yourself. Humans, with our broad chests, are almost uniquely ill-suited to move into the wind. Evolution has finely tuned our bodies into near-perfect pendulums. Our weight is aligned over our hips so that we can gently tip over, catch our fall, and repeat the process, aka walk, in a remarkably efficient way. Headwinds ruin all of that. Our broad, flat, rectangular chests turn into sails. In 70-mile-per-hour winds, you need to lean forward 15 degrees just to stand upright. Running into them is like sprinting up a 25-degree slope. You'll watch as dogs, deer, and most of the ambulatory animal kingdom use their sleek, aerodynamic bodies to cut through the wind, while you'll likely end up hanging onto a lamppost and cursing your sail of a chest. You could instead attempt to drive away, but again, the wind may foil your escape. In 1925, one of the most popular cars in America was the 20-horsepower Ford Model T. According to the manual, the Model T tops out at 45 miles per hour. Not bad, but there's a catch. The aerodynamics of the car are so poor that Road and Track likens it to a barn door. That's a problem in 100-mile-per-hour headwinds. Combine that with an inefficient engine and gearing issues that reduce horsepower at low velocity, and you have a car that, by my math, will redline at a speed only barely outpacing a runner. Footnote: if anything, I suspect 10 miles per hour might be a little optimistic. If you consider the reduced traction generated by the wind's lift, Model Ts do not have spoilers, and that the engine's gearing would not allow it to produce peak power at such low speeds, I think you might find yourself keeping pace with the runners. To make matters worse, the cabin of a Model T might be the worst tornado shelter in the history of human engineering. You'll be stuck inside a car with no safety features of any kind save for the horn. It has no seatbelts, no airbags, a large plate glass window, and aerodynamics that make it a serviceable kite in high winds. In the nearby city of Murfreesboro, Illinois, the Tri-State Tornado will launch a Model T over a building. Don't be in that car, or any car, or even try to escape. Instead, you need to hide. When I ask Maddox whether it's safer for you to run or drive away from the Tri-State Tornado, he advises neither. Seeking shelter is wiser, he says. Instead of running or driving, he advises you to use what little time you have to hunker down behind as many walls as possible and then wait as the most powerful winds in recorded history approach. That doesn't mean you should stay where you are. Some buildings are safer than others, and the train station happens to perform particularly poorly. The tornado hurls more than a dozen boxcars parked along the tracks, some into the railway station itself. Nothing remains of the wooden structure but the foundation. You may not be able to escape the tornado, but you do at least need to leave. Unfortunately, not a single building in Gorham survives the tornado intact. Because the entire town fit inside the girth of the storm, it's one of the few cities in history to sustain 100% tornadic destruction. So there are no great options, but there are particularly bad ones. Even within a tornado, there are many vortices of intense wind speed, small tornadoes within the tornado itself that inflict catastrophic damage. These mini vortices explain why one house might be lifted from its foundation while its neighbor merely loses its roof. In Gorham, Tri-State focuses its fury over Main Street, where vortices completely demolish the two-story bank, implode the town's large school, fling its multi-ton railway cars, and destroy its train station. Instead of running away from the tornado, use your 3 minutes to run south-southwest toward the oncoming tornado. That may seem like a dangerous choice, but Park Street is just 2 blocks to your southwest, and some of the houses on this street escape with far less damage than those on Main. The shield of heavy rain will have passed over you by the time you reach Park Street, and if you look up, you may now be able to see the focus of the storm. You may see a massive black cone descending from an even larger black anvil cloud, rotating and rising high above the cruising altitude of passenger jets. The twisting descent of the tornado likely won't resemble the traditional, defined, photogenic whip-like ones more frequently photographed. It's too wide, too powerful, and has picked up too much debris for that. Instead, it may seem as if the cloud itself has merely sagged to the ground. This development only makes the storm more dangerous. It obfuscates the speed and location of its twisting winds and makes it far more difficult to determine the tornado's true outline. But you shouldn't pay any attention to that. Instead, as you sprint down Park, you need to check the names on mailboxes. According to a newspaper account published in the Daily Independent a few days after the storm, only a handful of houses escaped total destruction in Gorham, and one of them was owned by a Mr. T.L. Spillman. According to this account, his house even served as a shelter for the wounded after the storm passed, so it should survive. Just don't stay with his neighbor. The same article says that house was flattened. Once inside, grab the strongest, largest pot you can find from the kitchen. You'll need this in a second. Then find the lowest, smallest room in the house and stuff yourself inside. A closet, a room under the stairs, or a bathtub provides a decent tornado shelter in the absence of a real one. A basement or an actual underground shelter would be ideal, but Midwestern townships primarily built their shelters in response to the tri-state storm, not before it. So a small room with sturdy walls to protect you from the hail of debris is essential. Once you're safely stowed away, take the large pot and put it on your head. You're going to use it as a helmet. Small rooms and stew pots are both good ideas because the primary danger in a tornado is not the strong winds themselves, but what those winds throw. The tri-state tornado will hurl cars, tractors, trains, and in one case will drive a wood plank 16 inches into a tree. As the tornado passes over you, thousands of splinters, nails, 2x4s, and train cars will fill the air, and every solid wall, bathtub, or stew pot you can place between yourself and those millions of projectiles might make the difference. Ideally, you would be underground while the chaos swarms above, but in your desperate situation, Mr. Spillman's iron pot and closet will have to do. Close yourself inside and wait as the roar of the wind crescendos into a howling scream, periodically punctuated by the sounds of crashing boxcars, tractors, cars, and the splintering of houses. If you look up and if you can see into the tornado's cone, you'll see flashes of lightning illuminate the dark twister, silhouetting bits of houses, railroad tracks, spikes, tractors, cars, and entire trees, all spinning within or ejected from the howling vortex. Fortunately, the horror passes in moments. Traveling at 70 miles per hour, the tornado will rip through Gorham in less than a minute. With a quick northwestern sweep, the supercell will flatten the town before advancing through the rest of southern Illinois and on to Indiana. Of Gorham's 500 residents, more than half suffer injuries and at least 34 people perish. There may not be in the entirety of America's long tornadic history a worse place to be than in Gorham, Illinois, at 2:35 p.m. on the afternoon of March 18, 1925. That may make it a dangerous place to see a steam locomotive, but it is one of the only places and times in history when you can see one of the 100-ton machines take flight.